now it's time for Rod and Reel Radio with your hosts, Hop Along John Cassidy, fresh and saltwater expert angler Stan Vanderberg, and all-around outdoors fishing and hunting enthusiast Wendy Toshihara. If you love the outdoors, enjoy salt or freshwater fishing, this is the show for you. We'll cover most all of the fishing tournaments and events with special reports while providing you with the information you need as to how and where to experience the best fishing opportunities in Southern California, Baja, Alaska, or just about anywhere the fish are biting. We have some fantastic guests and reports lined up for you this evening, so sit back, relax, and get ready for the fastest 2 hours in radio. It's all right here, right now, on Rod and Reel Radio, the best stop on your radio dial for all the information you need for fishing opportunities all over the United States. Now here's your host, Hop Along, John Cassidy.
Well, Mark Larson, thank you very much. And Southern California, welcome again to another Sunday edition of Rod and Reel Radio. I am indeed your underfished host, Hop Along John Cassidy. And it is our pleasure to welcome you to the show. And again, I believe there's a lot of you that have never listened to Rod Radio that may be tuned in to us. Rod and Reel Radio is basically a guest-generated show. Wendy, Stan, and I, we get together during the course of the week, and we contact those guests that we think are not only interesting to us, but will be of interest to you. And I think we've got a great show lined up for you tonight, and it's all going to be live. Out of the gate, we're going to have Rob Tressler from the San Diego Blood Bank. Rob is going to talk to us a little bit about some of the questions that have been concerning us about the coronavirus. So, yeah, I know that you probably are getting sick of hearing about it, but I think we've got some things that you're going to be interested in, and we might be able to answer some of the questions you've been asking yourself on some of the issues we'll be talking about. So Rob Tressler is going to be with us. And then later on, Stan Vanderberg. Yes, that's our own Stan Vanderberg. He's going to review for us some of the things we should be looking at when we are reviewing our boat insurance to make sure that you're covered for the things that you think you are and that you're not covered for those things you don't want to be covered for and everything else like that. So we'll have boat insurance 101 from our own Stan Vandenberg. And then to the second hour, former City Lakes manager of San Diego, Jim Brown, will be with us. We're going to talk about how bass got to the West Coast here. Not only the largemouth bass, we'll even touch on the northern bass, where they came from, where they were planted, how they got established. And then we'll also talk about the largemouth bass and then any other issues that we might want to bring to Jim's attention when it comes to bass being here on the West Coast. So it's going to be a great show tonight. But before we get started, let me introduce you to my co-host. First of all, this individual is the voice of 1-800-BASS-BOAT, and a pretty darn good fresh and saltwater angler in his own right, Stan Vandenberg. Stan, good evening to you tonight.
Good evening, everybody. Good evening, John, Wynn. It's been another week of, you know, just glorious bliss of in the Alona virus. Been alone in my garage a lot, redoing, undoing, and, you know, organizing tackle. I have bought a lot of different boxes I can put stuff in. And like you said last week, you know, I put a bunch of stuff in the box and I stack it. And then I go to look for something and I go, now, which one did I put it in? Even with labels on it, it's not working real well. So it's been fun to organize, though, and it definitely looks cleaner in some spots. Not all, but it's looking good.
Well, Stan, I hope you'll be able to find that stuff when you need it, because I know a lot of times I'll remember where, let's say I have a spy bait or a certain topwater bait, and I put it in where I, you know, let's say I put it where I have surface baits, and then all of a sudden I go to look at it and it's in the wrong surface bait box. So,
you know what the worst part is when I used to travel on the circuit a lot, each lake has its own personality, if you want to call it that. And I had boxes that were labeled like Lake Havasu, Lake Mead, Don Pedro, Millerton, you know, Castaic, Kachuma, all these places where the baits that were you used all the time that worked there, and those are there. So I've added to those boxes over the years. And I open it up and go, wow, there's some really great stuff in here. But now, where we were fishing in the tournaments and we could go onto the water, early in the year here, you know, everything was deep and you were set up for a whole style of fishing that now that by the time we get back in, everything's going to be off the down the beach and off the deep. So everything you have tied on at the boat right now, you've got to undo and redo, but you don't know when that's going to be. So, you know, it's been a challenging but fun sitting in the garage and in the boat reorganizing.
All right. Hey, Stan, let's introduce our listening audience to our other co-host tonight. She is the National Sales Manager for Isoline. She represents many other fine products in the fishing industry. She's also not only an excellent fisherman, but a hunter in her own right, Miss Wendy Toshihara. Wendy, how you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty good here on the Toshihara farm, where my chicks and my pigeons, my baby pigeons are doing great. The boys are doing good. And, you know, I'm going to have a huge array of vegetables soon.
Now, Wendy, you didn't start those all from seeds or what? Because I heard on the news today, besides there being a big run of toilet paper and hand sanitizer, now the big thing that is in short supply are plants at your local nursery, especially plants that generate food. Did you find that to be a problem?
I didn't, because I started in January, because I do this every year. And then I also save my seeds from the previous years. And so I planted a lot of seeds that I had grown.
Wendy, I think when this is all over, we need to come in and have a great ratatouille or something like that with you. That'll be fantastic.
All right.
The cool part is she's got all the vegetables and she's got chickens, so she's got fresh eggs. And if you've never had chickens or fresh eggs, you're missing.
Oh, you better believe it.
Not only that, I have all of the meat that we've hunted and the fish we've caught. So I'm good.
I had a deer last night. So, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I should say venison.
Venison.
Hey, guys, let's get to our first guest because he's on hold with us. You know, a lot of you fishermen have stood side by side on the rail next to this individual pumping either big bluefin tuna or maybe even going out on the half-day boats catching calico and sand bass. He and Lori were out, one or two times every weekend, so I know you know this guy well. But also, he wears another hat when he's not fishing. He is with the San Diego Blood Bank, and we want to welcome him to the show because I want to talk a little bit about some of the things about the coronavirus that maybe you haven't heard on the news. So let's welcome to Ron Real Radio, Mr. Rob Tressler. Rob, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, John, how are you? Hey, Wendy. Hey, Stan. Good to hear from you guys.
Hey, Rob.
Good to hear from you, Stan. Rob, man, I hope you and Lori are in good health and doing well.
We are. We're watching the social distancing practices. We have our homemade masks, cloth masks, face masks now as well. Wash our hands religiously and try to avoid touching our face, the common sense things that help reduce the risk of the COVID-19 contagion.
Oh, did we lose him?
I think we lost him.
Can you hear me?
Oh, there you are.
Hello.
Stay close.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, you sound far
away.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm holding the phone too far away. I apologize.
Perfect.
Okay.
That's better.
Okay.
I think we lost John.
Yeah, we're doing fine, John. We're doing fine. We're just practicing all the things that the FDA and the CDC has recommended. Social distancing, face mask now is the latest and greatest. Staying away from other people and washing hands and avoiding face contact.
Now, how is this as far as the blood bank goes?
Well, we've been very busy. The blood bank's been doing well. We've had a really good run of donors. They've been amazing coming in. We now have good reserves for the hospitals for the time being. I don't want people to become complacent, though. We still need donors to come in. But what we're doing now to assure that we do everything in compliance with safety and the COVID situation is we're requesting requiring people to make a reservation now. We're not doing walk-ins. The reason for that is we don't want a group of people stacked up in the parking lot. We're trying to avoid crowds and maintain that social distancing piece, and we found the most straightforward way to do that is to have people make an appointment and come in. That way we can spread them out, have them come in and collect the blood that's still needed by the hospital. So I want to encourage people to continue to go, and I want to thank you very much for doing so. It's been a really important thing for the blood bank. We're practicing. It's perfectly safe to give blood, by the way. We have all the safety practices and procedures, masking in place. We screen the donors. We ask you questions. We check your temperature and your symptoms and things like that before we'll even consider allowing you through the door of the blood bank. So it's perfectly safe, and we've had nothing go wrong.
Let me ask you a question here, bud. If during the coronavirus, this pandemic we're dealing with here, is there another level here of people that need blood? And is the blood, let's say some of these people that come in have they had the disease? Does their blood actually help to, you know, cure people that need blood that are maybe ill?
Yes, that's it's called the Convalescent Plasma Initiative. It was just launched in the last 2 weeks by the Food and Drug Administration. It's actually a national initiative now. And basically the concept here is a lot of people that get the COVID-19 virus don't die, thank goodness. They survive. And part of the reason they survived was their body generated an antibody response against the virus. And so those people that survived the virus and are now self-cured, if you will, they cured themselves because they were able to generate the antibodies that would kill and eradicate the virus. Those people are carrying those antibodies in their plasma now. So we actually started a task force. We started mobilizing for this a couple weeks ago, and we now have a formal task force to be part of the national initiative such that we will, once we get all the guidelines in place, we are going to look at collecting plasma from COVID clear people that were at some point in the past infected by the virus but are now absolutely cured, have no molecular or symptomatic evidence of the disease. If they are clean and don't have the virus, they're basically virus free, we will collect their plasma, freeze it down, and we're going to ship it to the centers that are carrying out. There's at least 3 clinical trials in the U.S. to treat COVID-19 patients with the plasma. There's one group of patients they want to treat that are advanced acute phase patients to see if they can stop them from expiring. Another group is the intermediate COVID patients that are in earlier stage of the disease. And then the third group is very early stage risk patients and treating them. And these trials are going to go on for months, I'm sure. But the immediate need, and the FDA has actually initiated what we call an EIND, and it's an emergency investigational new drug application, basically saying that qualified centers that are accredited with medical oversight, such as the San Diego Blood Bank and other blood centers, the Red Cross, and hospitals and facilities throughout the U.S., are going to be allowed to identify, recruit, and screen people who at one point in time in the past had COVID-19 but no longer have it, check them to make sure they have the antibodies, and if they do, collect that plasma and ship it to use in patients in acute need right now across the U.S. We're really excited about this program, and we're glad to be part of the national team that's working to try and save people's lives in the near term, not only with the blood products, but also with the convalescent plasma program. It's a wartime initiative for us. We've set hard deadlines. We meet 3 times a week. We've identified the sites we want to do it at, the policies, procedures, and the instrumentation and the staff. We've got to flesh all that out in the next week, and then we're going to get rolling. But it's a pretty amazing initiative, and I'm gratified by the hardworking dedication of our staff that are working on this. They're on the front lines right now collecting, and now they're going to take on this additional role to help save people's lives with COVID-19.
Now what if somebody went to give blood, you know, they passed, they were made it through the front doors, they didn't have a fever, they weren't showing any signs, they gave blood, and then what if they didn't even know they had COVID-19? Will you notify them that they did have it and they have the antibodies?
Yes, we will. We will. Ultimately, all the products are going to be screened or are in the process of being screened, and we would definitely notify them. We'd also notify them if they're active that they have to be quarantined. It's not going to happen. The probability of it happening is extremely remote. In fact, it's non-existent, in my opinion. But there's always a theoretical possibility. We have a very rigorous screening process. But if someone were able to slip through, we would then identify all staff that came into contact, all equipment, all materials that came into contact. It would be immediately quarantined, and staff would be monitored and would be quarantined and pulled off the floor. Obviously, we want to avoid that because we don't have a finite number of staff. But it's never right. been a problem so far. We've now collected thousands and thousands of blood donors in the past month, and we're batting 1,000 on that. But we would definitely notify the person if they've been exposed. It's just we do that routinely anyway. If we ever, when we screen for any of the pathogens, we mm-hmm. are, like for HIV, we're required to let them know by law. We're also by law required to notify the authority so they can track and trace. I don't know if that legislation is in place yet for COVID-19. I would suspect if not, it will be. But by default, we're going to do it anyway. We're going to notify them, please go see your primary care physician. Or if they're already clear of the virus and there are molecular tests that definitively will show that and they have a high antibody titer, we're then going to invite them and recruit them to see if they want to participate in the convalescent plasma program because their plasma could save someone's life.
All right. Hey, Rob, we've got to take a break right now, and I'm sorry I was called away on a very important call. Let's go to commercial right now, and we'll be back with Rob Tressler, and we have another report that is coming in even as I'm speaking now. We're going to maybe do that. So you're listening to Rod and Reel Radio on AM 540. Stan, Wendy, myself, and Rob Tressler will be back after these messages.
Hi, Roland Martin here. I'd like to tell you a little about Gary Yamamoto and the Gary Yamamoto Custom Bake Company. It all started with an idea, then a dream, and in 1983, the Gary Yamamoto Custom Bake Company was formed. If you know Gary Yamamoto like I do, and I've known him since 1983, you know he has a passionate love for the sport of fishing. That love is only matched by his obsession to design and produce the highest quality soft plastic fishing lures on the market today. Every bait Gary makes is inspected by hand. Today, more than 2.5 million packages of bait are shipped worldwide. On behalf of Gary and his staff, he wants to thank his customers for thinking so highly of his products and wishing you the great success at the sport of fishing. Whether you fish for fun or fish the tournament circuits like I do, you'll honor Gary for making Gary Yamamoto Custom Baits a key part of your fishing experience. Take it from me, Roland Martin. When I'm in need of a go-to bait, my first choice is a Gary Yamamoto Custom Bait.
Turner's Outdoorsman, California's number one fishing, hunting, and shooting sports retailer, now has 28 locations. Turner's is your one-stop shop for fishing tackle, hunting gear, and everything for shooting sports. Turner's offers a full selection and unmatched prices on the gear you need. Whether you're planning a fishing trip with the family or chasing giant tuna, Turner's highly skilled staff will make sure you have the gear for your next adventure. Visit Turners.com to find a Turner store near you and be sure to join the Turner's Discount Club to get weekly ads and specials right to your inbox. Turner's Outdoorsman, your one-stop shop for all your fishing needs.
We all like to travel, whether it's for business or it's pleasure, but one thing we all like to do, it's save money. Well, we got a travel tip for you. Bill Boyce has put together a travel website for you that can save you a lot of money. You can become your own travel agent. The site is bookwithboyce.com. You're going to save yourself 5 to 35% on all nationally advertised travel rates. You want to go to Mexico? You want to go to Hawaii? Bookwithboyce.com can offer you outstanding prices. And here's the deal. There's no surprises for accommodations, rental cars, or activities. So try bookwithboyce.com now and thank Bill Boyce later on.
Hi, this is Lori Heath. You may know me from some of the fishing boats out of San Diego. I want to talk to you about something that's really close to my heart. Did you know that when you donate blood, you're not only helping others, you're also helping yourself? Donating blood lowers the risk of heart attacks in men by more than 70%, lowers the risk of developing cancer, and helps you maintain a healthy liver. So donate blood to help someone else and to help yourself. If you can't donate, you can still make a difference with the financial gift. It's the best way to give back. Hook, line, and sinker. And for more information and to make a financial donation or an appointment, visit sandiegobloodbank.org. That's the sandiegobloodbank.org. And just to let you know, I'm also a blood donor.
Hey, Stan, Whitney, and I, we want to welcome you back to Rod and Reel Radio. Hey, this past Saturday, there was an incident that happened on one of the lakes back in Alabama. Our good friend Aaron Martins suffered from a seizure. And we have with us his mom, Carol Martins, to give us an update on exactly what happened. Carol, I know this is a trying period for you, not only with what's currently happening, but now with the situation with Aaron. Thanks for giving us a call. Can I ask you please to give us an update on what happened and what is happening?
Okay, first of all, what virus?
No kidding. Hi, Carol.
The last 24 hours, I forgot all about the virus. Let me tell you. It's just quite a hit. Talk about unexpected news to get on a Saturday morning when I'm listening to my church on the live streaming and get a text saying Aaron's been rushed to a hospital. And I'll try not to get teary, but it's very emotional.
The last
person in my family I would ever think would have an emergency, and he really didn't. I'm not sure it was a seizure. I haven't talked to Robbie, the guy he was with, personally yet, but the story is that he was just not acting himself. And, you know, we always tease Aaron about spin, you know, being so funny and mumbling and talking crazy, and that's what he was doing. And the people, I don't think, realized that he was actually just not being himself until he made a couple of statements that they knew weren't normal. And they actually called Leslie, and Leslie talked to Aaron, and he was really not being able to focus or think. So they brought him right home. They had his rig out there on the lake, and they got him back. Actually, he jumped up and got in the car when they said to get up off the boat floor. He was laying down, and he still has his energy. But they brought him to the house, and the ambulance was waiting there to take him to the hospital. But he must have awfully good medical care because they took care of everything really fast. They started testing him and got him all hooked up to, IVs and things. And to tell you the truth, yesterday it looked very dire. It just didn't feel right. Like there was just the prognosis was really, really scary. So we didn't really want to tell anybody what we were hearing, but today, this morning early, they took a test and they did a body scan. There was no cancer or anything in his body, which was a huge relief. Oh. And they do have these two little tumors. One of them is going to go tomorrow morning. They're going to take it out. And then he's going to be coming home Tuesday. And the prognosis is much better. They feel the other one they can treat. And in a week, we'll know what caused all this. They feel something caused the tumor to grow. So he's going to be laid up for a while for sure. But
oh my gosh.
I think, other than being scared, he admitted he was afraid, and guy, wouldn't anybody be?
Oh, heck yeah.
So, kidding.
What's his current state
Carol?
Is he lucid? Is he talking? Is he himself or what?
Yes. Yeah. Actually, he called me last night. His brother and his middle brother and his wife, who's a nurse, happened to already be planning to come over here. So we were in touch with Leslie a lot and stuff yesterday. And then, lo and behold, Aaron called us and talked to all of us. But it was hard to understand him because they had him medicated. So I'll never tease him again about mumbling. fast or anything. I wanted to say one thing to you guys, though. I almost wasn't sure I was going to give you a call because it's been a hectic day. But it's amazing when you've been fishing for over 30 years how many friends you have.
Oh, my. Especially Aaron.
Yeah, I just had to call you guys and just say how our family is a strong family where we have a lot of faith, and it's funny. It's funny, but we've picked out a lot of friends who have faith like we do. So it just feels like I know that the prayers are working. He has an extremely good doctor. The doctor said that he was praying for us. So when the doctor tells you he's praying for you, those are some good hands to be under.
That's absolutely great. I mean, I've known Carol and Aaron since they began fishing.
Right, exactly.
And we were, I mean, we've been friends a long, long time from the, like I said, from the very beginning. When I heard this, man, it was just, I'm like you, man. And I talked to several of the guys, you know, that we all grew up kind of around each other and fishing together. And a lot of tears are shed and a lot of prayers got up real, real quick with this.
I would say thousands and thousands from the stuff I've been getting. And Aaron knows it. He was, you know, we told him yesterday, everybody's praying for you. He says, I know. he's, I mean, you know, Aaron's not used to laying in bed with wires hooked up to him. And of all the people in the whole world, Aaron's always been the healthiest person I've known. And I think that's on his side, you know, being so healthy, and he'll get through the surgery just fine.
Now, I also hear, and it was posted, that he will probably come home on Tuesday after
yes.
the surgery, and then they'll wait for the results of the biopsies and then go from there. Is that a correct statement?
Yes. Yeah, actually, I was shocked because he hates the hospital, of course, and all that, and Leslie, it's been very upsetting because she couldn't go in the ambulance with him. And she hasn't mm-hmm. been with him this whole time. And I just think it's horrible, you know, that he doesn't have the virus. But the hospital is very strict about anyone coming into the hospital. So the good news is that he gets to come home. And I said, Leslie, it sounds like you're going to become a nurse. And she goes, I'm ready.
she
wants to come home.
And
I'm sure she's got the whole place set up, probably with flowers and everything.
You know, the worst part about these situations are the people. My daughter had to have surgery for cancer last 2 weeks. My wife was in Texas going through the same ordeal. I feel for you immensely on this. When Amy went in, they closed the door behind her, and you can't go in and sit next to the bed and talk with them or be
exactly.
supportive at all. You know, none of the family. So that's really the toughest part.
And the thing is, Trish, Chris, my middle son, Aaron's the youngest, and Chris is like almost 10 years older. His wife, Trish, is a nurse, and she's the head of a whole hospital floor out in the Antelope Valley. And, of course, it's been comforting to have her with me. She was here the last 24 hours, and they stayed overnight and stuff. But she knows everything about this type of thing. So she knows all the terms, what to ask. And she can actually call the nurse that's taking care of Aaron and talk to him. She can do that. So it's been really good as far as the hospital's doing everything they can to make him comfortable and happy. So definitely, I don't think it's affecting his mind at all at this point. And the surgery is going to be somewhere, they call it a quiet zone, which the one they're taking out tomorrow is kind of near the ear, but it's not in a real fragile place. So I don't think they anticipate any problems at all.
Well, Carol, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to give us a call.
I just didn't want to get all emotional on the phone because it's hard to talk.
I understand
I don't talk
that.
Good. I mean, talking is my gift, but I've had a lot of tears, you know, the last 24 hours.
We understand that.
The whole of the fishing community is behind you, and I can't tell you how many guys have texted me to see if I knew anything more, you know, and that's you have prayers coming up from all of us that love and know you for the last umpteen years.
Well, it's over 30.
Yes, it's over 30.
It's been a long time since
years.
Those beginnings with ABA and stuff like
world.
That, Carol. Carol, if you will, I'll stay in contact with you, and next Sunday. If you can give us another update, I can't tell you how much we'd appreciate it.
I just have a strange feeling. It wouldn't even surprise me if Aaron will want to come on the show when he's feeling better. So maybe we can get him to do that.
That would be awesome.
Well, that would be great. You just tell him on behalf of Wendy, Stan, and all of us here at Rod and Reel Radio and throughout Southern California, man, we're pulling for him. And I think he can probably feel that love from where he is.
I'm sure he does. He already said so.
And make sure you tell Leslie we love her too, and we have all the strengths in the world.
This is really hard for her, but she's a fighter. She's really good at handling problems.
All right. Carol, thank you so much for giving us a call, okay?
Okay, thanks for all the love, you guys.
Okay, we'll talk to you again.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
All right.
Bye-bye.
And for those of you who don't know, that was Carol Martins. That was Aaron Martin's mom kind of giving us the up-to-date. A lot of little details there that we didn't know about. But I think Stan and Wendy, under the circumstances, I don't know how you could get a better report.
No.
Yeah, no kidding. And she's just, I mean, how strong is Carol? You know, after everything she's gone through and now her son.
All right. Hey, guys, let's get back to Rob Tressler. Rob, are you still there? And were you listening to that interview that we had with Carol?
I was in awe. I remember as a youngster, as a young adult, seeing the Team Crown Royal logo with the boat with Carol and Aaron Martins. And Aaron Martins is a very cerebral fisherman. He's been one of my heroes all my bass fishing life. I mean, he's an amazing guy. Super fit, super healthy. It's really going to go towards helping him with the therapy. The biopsy is really going to tell the tale, you know, to see what it is exactly, you know, that hopefully it's not a malignant glioma and that it's something. I was at MD Anderson for 10 years. I trained there. And a good friend of mine was the head of neuro-oncology, Al Young. He's actually world famous as a, he's retired now as a brain cancer specialist. But I'm certain Aaron's in the best of hands. All prayers to him for this.
Man, that is, and Rob, she said they're going to remove one tumor, and then there's another area that they're going to leave alone and try to treat that. Will that mostly be some type of chemotherapy or proton radiation or what?
It's typically a proton beam radiation, irradiation therapy, and then they'll do a consolidation with a chemotherapeutic, and there's a lot of different flavors of chemo that they might try. And a lot of that's going to be dependent on his personal fortitude and strength. And this guy's a tough nut. So I think he's in good hands. And I think he's got a bright future ahead of him in this. The tale to tell will be the biopsy of the primary that they're going to remove and the secondary as much as they can image it. But we'll wait and see. We'll find out in another week or so. And I'll be all ears listening on the radio to hear how that goes.
Well, and Rob, I'm sorry that we interrupted right in the middle of your interview. We have a couple of minutes left before we've got to take a break over here right now. But can I get you to stay on with us for just a little bit longer so we can finish some of the questions that we had?
Sure. And okay. Now I've got this phone figured out, so I shouldn't cut out on you. My apologies.
Well, and tell us then, in just the brief couple of seconds that we have, has Lori caught anything while we've been on the phone?
I think she's fallen asleep. Oh, no, she's listening to the radio show on her phone, on a podcast, I guess.
Well, great. We're glad to do that. Hey, Otto, we're going to break right now, so it might be a little bit early, but you're listening to Rod and Reel Radio on AM 540. We're going to be back with Rob Tressler after these commercial messages.
Hi, this is John, and I'd like to invite you to the new Angler's Arsenal location in Lakeside, California. We've put together a staff of experts that'll help you find the tackle and gear you need at a price you can afford. We carry all major brands. And if you need custom work done, we can do that for you with both rods and reels. How about servicing your old equipment? No problem. We can do it quickly, easily, at a price you can afford. We also do custom hand-poured plastics through Western Plastics. Design the lure of your dreams and catch the fish that have been getting away. So come and visit us in Lakeside. We're at 12255 Woodside Avenue. Or you can visit us at anglersarsenal.com. If you need to call us, we're at 619-466-8355. See you there.
Gamakatsu hooks are made from high-grade carbon steel specially heat-treated to make them light and extra strong but not brittle. The Gamakatsu sharpening process is the most modern in the world and results in a perfectly conical point that is unequaled in sharpness. Gamakatsu offers a huge variety of hooks for all types of fishing, drop shot, extra wide gap, worm hooks, finesse wide gap, and a lot more. Gamakatsu has a hook for whatever style of fishing you want to do. Don't waste your time on a cheap hook. Ask for Gamakatsu hooks at your favorite tackle store now.
We want to tell our listeners a little about Bajo La Luna restaurant, located within a lush hidden garden in the heart of Cabo San Lucas. This family-run restaurant offers patrons a selection of unbelievable tapas, the most delicious Mexican entrees, an outstanding selection of wines and crafted cocktails, and the most amazing desserts, all served in an upscale, casual, outdoors atmosphere at prices you'll find very affordable. When you visit Bajo La Luna, mention Rod and Real Radio, and there might just be a complimentary beverage served with your dining experience. Bajo La Luna is located right across the street from Cabo Wabo and offers free or valet parking. Get all the information you'll need to visit Bajo La Luna restaurant on Facebook. Just click their direct link icon found on rodandrealradio.com.
Are you looking for a quality fishing experience out of Cabo San Lucas for you, your family, and friends, but are a little set back with what charter company to choose? We urge you to use American and family-owned Lands End Charters. Lands End Charters offers their passengers affordable and all-inclusive services on a variety of vessels and trips. Fish with the latest of fishing gear while experiencing the hospitality of a long-time-owned family business. Go to lensandcharters.com to see all of their vessels and amenities available. Call Cobble, Greg, or Jenny at 800-281-5778 when you're ready for an action-packed Cabo fishing experience.
Hey, everybody. This is a message for our listeners from a new Baja Magic Lodge at Cedros Island. Cedros Outdoor Adventures wants to make your dream of fishing Cedros Island a reality. Want to go after giant calicos or yellowtail with the best Cedros Island fishing organization, but you just don't know who to contact? Then give Cedros Outdoor Adventures a call at 619-793-5419, or even better yet, log on to their informative website at cedrosoutdooradventures.com. There you can visit their trip calendar and schedule a trip that's convenient for you. Once again, the phone number is 619-793-5419. Or their website of CedrosOutdoorAdventures.com.
Rod and Reel Radio is brought to you by BajaBound.com Insurance Services. Are you driving to Mexico? You can buy and print out your Mexican auto insurance policy online in the convenience of your own home or office in minutes now with BajaBound.com's easy-to-use website. After printing your auto insurance, check out the BajaBound.com site. There, too, you will find great travel tips and information to help you get the most out of your next road trip south of the border. So this is an important fact to remember. Use BajaBound.com. It's the easiest way to find and get Mexican auto insurance.
If you're serious about your fishing, choosing the right tackle is one of the most important decisions you'll ever make. Iserline makes premium fishing lines, including monofilament, Dacron, Spectra, fluorocarbon, battle-tested harnesses, and top angler-tested Iserline tools and accessories. Iserline premium fishing products are created to provide you with the ultimate in strength, dependability, durability, high abrasion resistance, low stretch, and high quality. All Iserline products are 100% guaranteed against manufacturing defects. You just can't buy better value. Iserline will replace or repair at their option, no questions asked, if you're not pleased with any of their products. Catch what you've been missing. Quality guaranteed.
Rod and Reel Radio is now available as a podcast you can subscribe to on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcasting app. Get notified as soon as new episodes are available, or go back and listen to our past shows. Browse through all of our archive shows at rodandreelradio.com/archives and click the subscribe button to get started listening now.
Stan, Wendy, and I, we want to welcome you back to Rod and Reel Radio. Hey, you know, Stan, Wendy, and I, we've got to thank our sponsors very much, because without them, we wouldn't be able to put the show on and run it the way we want to run it. And I've got to tell you, we had to drop a few sponsors in that first bank of commercials to get Carol Martins on. The last thing I wanted her to do was be waiting on the phone listening to a bunch of commercials while the bullets were flying around her. And
this is a hard enough time right now for any business, and especially the sponsors that we have. We want to thank Gary Yamamoto, Bates, Ronnie there. We want to thank Mike at Turner's. We want to thank Debbie at the San Diego Blood Bank, Cabo Greg at Lands End Charters. We want to thank Terry over at Ecolizer. We want to thank Jose at Cedros Outdoor Adventures. We want to thank Bill Boyce at BookWithBoyce.com. Sissy at Cabo San Lucas down at the Baja de Luno. Also thank Greg Hill at Baja Bound. And also Stan at 1-800-BASS-BOAT. Wendy at Iserline. Also Angler's Arsenal, H&M Landing, Gamakatsu. It's all these people that bring the show to you. And we couldn't do what we're doing without their support. It's a tough time. When we get past all of this, I ask you to listen to the people that are advertising with us. They're all great sponsors. And make sure you take advantage of the products that they are advertising with us here on the show. Because we want to keep on coming back to you, and we can't do it without them. Hey, let's go back to Rob Tressler now. We were talking a little bit about the coronavirus and some of the things we should be looking at. And Rob, when people come to the blood bank, how do you know if they have the virus or if they are carrying it? What precautions do you make? And can the virus be transmitted through blood?
So a lot of studies are underway right now and have been completed looking at blood transmission of the virus. And to date, nothing's been seen, which is good. Having said that, we still screen everybody before they're even allowed in the building. We do a symptomatic check for fever, for coughing, for anything that even if it's a mild, even if it seems like, oh, I just got a little bit of a cold, we ask them to please not come in and donate. We thank them for coming. We ask them to please wait until they're clear of everything, and then we'll reconsider and have them come back and rescreen them again. But we check everybody's temperature. All of our staff are masked and gloved to protect themselves, but also to prevent cross-contamination. We then have a series of questions. We ask them, have they come into contact with anybody that they know was COVID-19 positive or might have possibly been, in other words, was sick with flu-like symptoms, or was traveling to areas, or were they themselves personally traveling to areas on luxury liner boats, you know, cruises, or to other countries like the Far East, or even certain hotspots in the U.S., Louisiana, Florida, and New York. We query them about where they've been. And if they've been any place that is even remotely suspicious, we ask them to please rebook with us in 28 days when they're clear, because that's how long the virus takes to clear, and we'd be happy to take their donations in. We've collected thousands of donors over the past couple of weeks. The community has responded marvelously, and we have not had a single incident to date. But we're practicing a lot. We're also keeping people separated. The reason we now require reservations is we can't have people stacked up or getting close to each other. So within the facility and even in the parking lot, we're requiring people to keep their distance. Once they're inside, we've spaced out all our donor collection sites now, rearranged the furniture, if you will, to keep everybody distant, so that we could mitigate any risk, even if someone, if there was a remote, and it would be very remote, chance of someone ever coming through the door inadvertently, even then we're treating people like they might be at risk, and therefore we're keeping everyone separated, and staff are changing out gloves and masks to maintain safety. And it's perfectly safe to give blood as long as you keep these practices in place, which is what we're doing at all the blood banks across the nation.
Also, Rob, the state of California, the county of San Diego, the San Diego Port District, a lot of municipalities up and down the state are coming under criticism, especially by fishermen, that our fishing grounds have been closed, not only our access to freshwater fishing spots, but also saltwater spots, the fact that the launch ramps are closed, shore fishing is now prohibited, surf fishing, you can't do that. You know, the only place you can find a place to fish is a place where there isn't anybody at all, so you don't have anyone to hassle you. What is your thought about these closures in light of what we know about the virus and how it can be transmitted?
Well, the problem is human nature. Honestly, you know, as long as people stay, you know, if you're out in the, you're outdoors and you're 100 yards or 50 yards away from other humans, you're fine. It's not going to carry. It is aerosoled. By the way, there are some issues about this. This thing is super contagious, but it's contagious if you're close. If you're staying away from people, it's not an issue. But what happened was, and 2 weekends ago, Lori and I just went for a drive down by the landings and over by Mission Beach, just looking around. We didn't even get out of the car. We just over. And at that point in time, people were all told, wash your hands, stay away from others, six feet distance, social distancing. And people were clustered up and playing soccer and football and huddled up, drinking their wine. And so I think what happened was the authority says, okay, we tried. We asked people to play nice. They're not doing it. And this thing is serious. This is a highly contagious monster. So they said, we're gonna fault possibly a little bit to the excess in terms of restricting people in terms of getting into the wild outdoors. But even in the Imperial Valley, we drove past an area, and there were 20 RV homes and 20 sand dune buggies, and they were all having a barbecue, you know, a mixed group of 30 or 40 people. What are you going to do? You know, after a while, you just say, okay, guys, we tried. We're going to close, you know, the dunes to dune buggy driving, which is about as solitude as you get. You got to have common sense. Unfortunately, humans like people. So we tend to say, well, just this one time, you know. And just that one time, like the choir up in, where was it, in Washington? I don't know if you heard about it. There was a choir of, I guess, 30 or 40 people. And just this one time, let's have choir practice. We'll practice safe distancing. We'll do our singing and be belting out our songs without masks. 19 people got COVID positive, and two or three of them have now died. So, man, you know, it's like, okay, we tried to count on each individual to be an adult and behave appropriately, and we slip, and we can't afford that. We can't afford it. One person can infect, which is called an, it's an, the debate is still going on about its level of contagion, but a highly contagious flu virus is about a R 1.4 to 1.8, which means 1.4 to 1.8 people will be infected by one person who has it. This thing has been debated as being as high as an R3 or an R4. It's triple or quadruple the contagious potential of influenza. If that's true, that's very scary. And right now, from the way that the infectivity and COVID positive signals are coming back from places like New York and others, it indicates that it is extremely contagious, extremely contagious. Now, 80% of the people that become COVID-19 positive don't die. They recover. They do fine. In fact, probably a higher percentage than that are fine, but 20% or so have to go to the hospital for medical intervention. And right now, the last place you want to go is a hospital, for obvious reasons.
Rob, I got a question. A lot of people just are real confused about what symptoms are the symptoms from this COVID-19. There are colds that are going around, and people actually have gotten the cold. And some people say they may have gotten this already and had a real tough time with a cough that lasted for 2 or 3 weeks and didn't want to go away. But I think there's a lot of confusion as to how this presents itself.
Yeah, and it's a sneaky disease, as it turns out. The classic symptoms are a high fever, a dry cough, not a wet cough, a dry cough, okay? And upper respiratory pain and severe profound fatigue. The reason for the fatigue is because the dry cough is elicited by the fact that your lungs are stressed because they're infected and they're not transpiring oxygen into your blood as effectively, and that begets the severe fatigue that people have. The virus also can infect your GI tract, but that's variable, so you can have diarrhea, but that's not always the case. So basically, it can look like a really bad flu or cold, but if it's a wet cough, you know, with a lot of sputum and stuff, it's probably not COVID-19. But we don't know if the COVID-19 is sitting on top of you also having a cold. So we're defaulting to say, if you had anything, we're considering you someone that we're going to defer and we're not going to take blood from. And if you yourself have something, and we're in hay fever season right now, great, to further confound things, just pretend you might be and keep your distance, you know? And obviously there are family members you've been with, like I've been next to what's-her-name. I mean, Lori, my beautiful, lovely fiancé. But, you know, other than that, if you have a new friend you haven't seen in a while and they have a cold or something, I don't care if it's just a cold. That's fine. Don't get within 6 feet of me, okay? If you're sneezing, cover up. So the mask thing you've heard about, you know, because at first it was like, well, we don't think you need the mask, or maybe you do need masks, or what's the saga of the mask? So for masks, there's what is known as an N95 mask, and that mask actually protects you from the virus because it has a microfilter, air filter system in it. They're hard to come by, they're expensive, and frankly, because we have such a low inventory, they really should be reserved for frontline people treating active COVID patients to protect them so they don't become infected, so they can treat and minister to these patients, okay? There are just the regular face masks, or now we're saying cloths and scarves, and I know that in California, but I know in San Diego, they're saying everybody should cover their face. Well, why is that? Well, it's not that it's per se going to protect you if someone sneezes in your face, because the virus can be in these microscopic particles that are very tiny that can drift right through the mask if you inhale them. But what it does do is it helps to prevent you from spreading it to others, because the majority of that microsol stuff that you sneeze out will be trapped by the mask. It's not a complete fix at all. Some can still get out and there's still risk, but it's just an additional barrier. So the concerns that were had early on, well, if we tell everybody to wear masks, they're not going to practice what really works as effectively as they should, which is social distancing, washing your hands, and not touching your face. In fact, they did a study and showed that people that wore the mask touch their face more than people that don't.
Oh, man.
So they said, Robbie, what do we do with this, you know?
Here's the last question, and then we're gonna cut you loose so you can get on back. There is no vaccine for this. There is no medication we can take. We can't get rid of this with an aspirin or Aleve or Advil. We're going to be reaching a peak here in a couple of weeks in all the various states. What is it going to take to beat this thing? This is kind of like the Australia brush fires. There's just nothing available to stop it. So what is it going to take without us having any medications, any vaccines to beat this thing and get on the other side of this curve?
So eventually we will have vaccines. We know now that it can be, vaccines will be able to be successful, but those are a year to a year and a half out, okay? Maybe sooner. We may be able to have them within 6 to 12 months if we really are heroic and lucky. Also, medications are being looked at. There are a number of clinical trials looking at chloroquine and other things. The efficacy for those is marginal, but eventually we'll probably find a medication for it as well, too. But all of that's a year or so away. In the meantime, we've got to stop this thing in the next 6 months, next 3 months or so. And it's simple. And it's 90% preventable. Social distancing, number one. Okay. Number two, wash your hands. Don't touch your face. Number three. Okay. Number four, if you think you have come into contact with someone, keep yourself away from everybody else. If you think you're coming down with it, see your physician and get confirmed one way or the other and get tested. The other thing that we still are really short on that's going to help us to get a handle on tracking and sequestering people is testing people. South Korea got out of the woods because they tested almost everybody in the country. And they said, all right, now you're positive. Guess what? You're quarantined for 14 to 28 days minimum. Who did you come into contact with? Tell us now. Okay, you came into contact with persons X, Y, and Z. Persons X, Y, and Z, we're testing you. You're negative? Nonetheless, 14 days. You're positive? 28 days. They really clamped down, and they got it under control. If we practice some common sense things, social distancing, good hygiene practices, we will get it under control. The cat's out of the bag in certain hotspot areas, and you can't gather in large groups, people. You can't. You simply can't.
All right. And Rob,
a lot of these areas that there's concentrations, the people are living next door to each other. They're 5 feet away, door to door. I mean, they're in highly concentrated areas, and a lot of people there that there's no way to really stretch yourself out. And there's other areas where you got some space between you, But that 6 foot space has been an important thing. A lot of people don't realize how important that is.
Rob, yeah. Also,
and I want to applaud. Yeah, go ahead. I want to applaud the sport fishing fleet. They realized the bunks in the sport boats were too close. We had to shut down. It was the right thing to do.
Rob, is there any evidence that if someone has the virus or has gotten the virus and has gotten over it, that they now have an immunity, or is it mutating, do you think, in such a way that they could catch it again?
The mutational rate right now looks low. There have been some anecdotal reports from China of people that tested negative, had gotten through COVID-19, tested negative, were confirmed negative, and then on retest a month later came up positive, but we're not sure if that was simply a faulty test or if it's the real thing. To date, we're not seeing recurrence. Now, you are going to see a second wave of COVID because right now we're on that first peak, which is the scary one. And what we're trying to do by flattening the curve there, John, is we're trying to maintain the level of infection at a level that our hospital facilities can manage. The problem is, for those people that need respirators, if you don't get one, you die. Or the probability of you dying is very high. And we have more people coming down with COVID than we have respirators in certain parts of the U.S. That's terrifying for a doctor. In Spain and Italy, it forced doctors to make Sophie's choice. They had to choose who died and who didn't die. They actually formalized criteria for who would be allowed to get a respirator and who would not, knowing what they were doing when they did that at times was possibly signing a death sentence for people. We're trying to flatten the curve here, so we never see that here in the U.S. That's why New York is so frantic. And Gavin Newsom, you know, bless his heart, he was one of the first governors to say, you guys stay home. And he took some criticism at first, but in hindsight, it was prudent. California, for the size of the state and the population densities we have in the Bay Area and Southern California, it's remarkable the level of infectivity and death to date has been gratifyingly low compared to other sites.
All right. Rob, we're going to let you go at that. Thank you for taking time out of being with Lori and doing what you're doing to be with us. And let's check in with you again when we get some further updates on what's happening. And hopefully we can get on the downside of this coronavirus curve a lot quicker than right now it looks like we're going to be.
We will eventually, but I think we've got another month to a month and a half minimum.
Okay.
I'm hopeful.
Hate to end it on that note, but Rob, thanks a lot for being with us, sir.
Take care.
All right. Hey, we got a little overtime. We're going to take a break right now, but coming up next, we're going to go on to a little happier note, I think. We're going to be talking with the former San Diego City Lakes manager, Jim Brown. We're going to find out how did bass get out here to the West Coast. So stay tuned. We'll be coming back with you after these messages.
Turner's Outdoorsman, California's number one fishing, hunting, and shooting sports retailer, now has 28 locations. Turner's is your one-stop shop for fishing tackle, hunting gear, and everything for shooting sports. Turner's offers a full selection and unmatched prices on the gear you need. Whether you're planning a fishing trip with the family or chasing giant tuna, Turner's highly skilled staff will make sure you have the gear for your next adventure. Visit Turners.com to find a Turner store near you and be sure to join the Turner's Discount Club to get weekly ads and specials right to your inbox. Turner's Outdoorsman, your one-stop shop for all your fishing needs.
Hi, Roland Martin here. I'd like to tell you a little about Gary Yamamoto and the Gary Yamamoto Custom Bait Company. It all started with an idea, then a dream, and in 1983, the Gary Yamamoto Custom Bait Company was formed. If you know Gary Yamamoto like I do, and I've known him since 1983, you know he has a passionate love for the sport of fishing. That love is only matched by his obsession to design and produce the highest quality soft plastic fishing lures on the market today. Every bait Gary makes is inspected by hand. Today, more than 2.5 million packages of bait are shipped worldwide. On behalf of Gary and his staff, he wants to thank his customers for thinking so highly of his products and wishing you the great success of the sport of fishing. Whether you fish for fun
official tournament circuits like I do, you'll honor Gary for making Gary Yamamoto Crystal Baits a key part of your fishing experience. Take it from me, Roland Martin. When I'm in need of a go-to bait, my first choice is a Gary Yamamoto custom bait.
Hey, bass fishermen. Who do you call for your bass boat insurance? Well, if you're not calling me at 1-800-BASS-BOAT for your boat insurance, you're probably paying too much and may not have the coverage that you need. In 1974, I developed the Bass Boat Program that is what all the pros use today. The reason? No depreciation or any partial claim for your hull, your big motor, your trolling motor, or your electronics until your boat's 10 years old. That's right, you only pay $250 to get your boat on the water for any partial claim, and we still pay a stated value replacement cost for your boat if you have a total loss. We're the only people in the industry that does that, and that's why we are the choice of the pros. So if you want the best, forget the rest. Just call 1-800-BASS-BOAT. Call 1-800-227-7262 or just spell Bass Boat. 1-800-BASS-BOAT. I know there's too many letters, but the T is free and the call's on me. That's 1-800-BASS-BOAT, the choice of the pros for bass boat insurance. For more information, log on to 1-800-BASS-BOAT.com.
Hi, this is Lori Heath. You may know me from some of the sports boats out of San Diego. I want to talk to you about something that's really close to my heart, the San Diego Blood Bank. Fishing for a way to make a difference in your community? Consider donating blood or making a financial donation to the San Diego Blood Bank. Your gift will impact medical research, revolutionize how we improve health and treat disease, and most importantly, give the gift of life. But we can't do it without you or without your help. Visit sandiegobloodbank.org to make an appointment or to give a financial donation today. It's the best way to give back. And just to let you know, I'm also a blood donor.
Southern California, Stan, Wendy, and I, we want to welcome you back to Rod and Reel Radio. And before we get to our next guest, Stan, I need to apologize to you because I know you had prepared a whole presentation on bass boat insurance and what people should look for and ask for and everything like that. And we took that call from Carol Martins to give us the update on Aaron. Can we save that for a show in the not-too-distant future and do it again? Because not only is it an interesting subject, it's an important subject that anyone that owns a boat needs to know.
That's simple for me. I mean, this is an everyday thing for me. Biggest thing I can tell you guys is most insurance agents do not know. One, they don't own a boat, and they don't know what the difference between the different companies is that insure boats. That's pretty scary to me. If you don't have somebody that knows what the difference is between the different insurance companies that are out there, because not all insurance, boat insurance, is created equal, give us a call, 800-227-7262. It's 800-BASS-BOAT. The T is free and the call's on me. But a lot of people, they got their, you know, friend told them, here, buy this from Progressive or buy this from the dealership or buy this from, you know, your buddy, the Allstate or whatever. There are a ton of things that have changed in the last year, especially companies that have gone out of business, companies that have changed their coverage. And what you think you've got, I guarantee you don't. We need to kind of go through this, but at a different time. Everybody's staying at home right now, so we can do it later, and I'm great.
And again, if your insurance is coming up or you want to review it, give Stan a call, 1-800-BASS-BOAT. You might get the answering machine because we're all, you know, not working on full schedules right now, but I can assure you, Stan, Ken, or one of those people there will get back to you. Stan, thanks a lot again for your understanding with that. But guys, let's go to our next guest because this has been a subject I can never talk enough about. And every time I talk to someone about this who's in the know, I learn something new, and that's how bass got to the West Coast here. Not only the largemouth bass, but the northern bass. And who better to ask this question to than the former San Diego City Lakes manager, Mr. Jim Brown, and he's with us tonight. Jim, welcome to Rod and Reel Radio.
John, thank you very much, and hello, Stan and Wendy.
Hello there.
Yeah, Wendy's here too. Jim, I guess the first thing I need to ask you, manager of the San Diego City Lakes, I've talked to you. This was a dream job for you. Tell us a little bit about where you came from to reach this position in the City Lakes system.
Well, I was born and raised in San Diego. My dad was a veteran of the Navy, and after World War II, he got out, and his passion, his one great passion in life besides his family was fishing. And so by the time I was 3 or 4 years old, I think he was taking me fishing as a good excuse to get out of the house by himself, just for himself. But I think there was a deal in which I had to be tagging along, and it worked out just fine. So any lake, any stream, the bays, just everywhere. He loved to fish, and that really got me started. And we fished at Lake Sutherland a great deal. In fact, I was at the very first opening day at both El Capitan and Sutherland, but Sutherland was our favorite. And by the time I was 12 years old, the staff up there asked me to move into the lake and work for room and board, which I did. It was, a lifetime dream for a kid who didn't ever read anything that he was assigned to read, but read every field and stream, outdoor life, and sports of field that he could find. So,
sure.
Sorry, that's pretty good. I understand that, though.
That was, growing up, that was it for me. And I was on the lake fishing all the time with my dad, and I always liked what the people that worked at the lakes did, and I would help them out, and I'd be cleaning boats. And, probably to some degree, I was that nuisance kid that wouldn't go away. And when I was 13, I went to an eighth grade careers conference, and I hope to revive that for young people in this county at some time again. But anyway, they brought together people from Fish and Wildlife, the Department of Fish and Game, county, estate, and national parks, and everyone had a booth set up and told the kids what they had to do to prepare for a job. And at the end of the conference, people who were the presenters were all seated at a dais. And they came around and asked each one of us kids what we'd like to do. And I imagine the kids next to me wanted to be game wardens or national park rangers. And when they came to me, I just pointed at Orville Ball, who was then the City Lakes manager, and I said, I want Mr. Ball's job. So I was 13. And 14 years later, I had the job.
Well,
but there was a lot in between. Do you want me to fill you in with some of the in-between stuff, like taking over Otay and some of the other things, John?
Let's don't do that yet. Let's do kind of as advertised. We had mentioned bass coming to the West Coast. I know I've heard some stories on the first bass that came to the West Coast that they were Northerns. What is the stories that you've heard that you think are credible on the first bass coming out here to the West Coast, and especially to Southern California?
I don't have the book that I recently loaned to someone. There's a great book published by the Department of Fish and Game called Introduced Fishes of California. And so it had it. But my recollection in reading that, I believe it was 1873, but it could have been 83. But I want to say 1873, the U.S. Fish Commission, which preceded the Fish and Wildlife Service, would go ahead and there'd be tanker cars headed west from the East Coast, and they would throw fish in. And as the story went, as they would pass by lakes and rivers and streams, they'd take a few fish and toss them all out. And that's actually how the European carp got here as well. It was anticipated that they would be a food fish for folks, but they brought the carp and the bluegill, and the bass, as I recall, came out of Illinois. And so those were the northern strain black bass that we enjoyed fishing for here up until the arrival of the Floridas, which, as everyone knows, have virtually taken over everywhere that they've been stocked in any number.
Well, tell us, Jim, I think I've heard the story not only from Orville, but also from George Jessup and a few other people. How was the seed planted to bring the largemouth bass here to the West Coast? And what was the actual mechanics that were involved in getting here? And I understand that there were a couple of, stumbles along the way. So if you can relate the story, that would be great.
All right. Well, there were some hurdles. You're correct on that, John. But this all began as three fishermen were drifting for crappie at Lake Henshaw. And in that boat were Rolla Williams, who was the outdoor writer for many years for the San Diego Union. There was Orville Ball, who was managing the City Lakes. The third person was Ray Boone, father of Bob Boone. So this is the Boone baseball family of San Diego. And Ray Boone was, since he was with Orville, who was a fisheries guy, he just wanted to know, why was it in spring training in Florida that you could go out and, catch a 7, 8, 9, maybe a 10-pound bass? And growing up and spending a lot of time fishing in San Diego, a big bass was going to be a 5-pounder most of the time. So it got Orville to thinking, and they finished their fishing trip, and he came back and started thinking about Florida bass. He had very good fortune in that Carl Hubbs, who is considered America's preeminent fisheries biologist of all time, at that time was working at Scripps. Now, modern-day anglers have heard of the projects at Hubbs SeaWorld, and that's named after him. But at that time, Carl Hubbs was on staff out at Scripps. Orville went to see him and said, look, I kind of have this idea of bringing Florida bass out here to see if there's any difference. And so it's just an unbelievable coincidence. But Hubbs responded that he had done graduate work studying the taxonomic differences of the black basses. And so he felt that it was certainly worth a try. And this gave Orville a great boost of momentum that Carl Hubbs would say, there could be a difference. And at that time, the California Department of Fish and Game took a different approach. They said, this is, a waste of time. And if you take bass from San Diego and put them down in Florida with those 12-month growing conditions and the volume of food that they have there, our bass will grow just as large. So we don't want to see you do this. So Orville persisted, and he continued to have trouble with them. And Dave Jessup, who was a longtime San Diego County sportsman and a very prominent person, got involved. And that was a good thing, because at that time he was on the Fish and Game Commission for the state, as well as the county Fish and Wildlife Commission. So Jessup kind of knocked down some of those hurdles that Orville couldn't get through in Fish and Game, and made a deal with Florida to bring out some Florida bass. And these would be very small fish that were brought out from a hatchery. And the first load in 1959 arrived here. But when they were getting ready to release them into Upper Otay, which had been rotenone to kill all other fish out of it, so that the Florida bass alone would be in there, he examined the fish, and they had ick. So any of you who have had tropical fish know that ick can be a periodic problem with fish, and the pathologist ordered all of those fish killed.
Right. Hey, Jim, can we break right now? We need to take a commercial break.
For Ball.
Yeah. Jim, let's take a break right now. Can we please?
You got it. I'm off.
All right. Hey, great. Hey, we're talking about the story on how largemouth bass got here to Southern California with Jim Brown. There's a lot of twists and turns to this story before bass start really populating our city lakes, and we're gonna explore those. But first, a commercial break. You're listening to Rod and Reel Radio on AM 540. Stan, Wendy, Jim Brown, and I will be back after these messages.
Angler's Arsenal is the serious angler's first choice for hand-poured plastics, McCoy Line, Spro Products, Gamakatsu Hooks, G. Loomis Fishing Rods, Shimano Products, Ovid Reels, and just about anything you hear advertised on Rod and Reel Radio. Go to anglersarsenal.com and visit our online tackle store. See the huge selection of Western Plastics hand-poured baits, all at anglersarsenal.com. Angler's Arsenal Tackle Store is conveniently located in La Mesa, just off Interstate 8. Give us a call at 1-800-428-8730.
Every serious angler knows that a quality hook is an important part of their arsenal. Gamakatsu hooks are made from high-grade carbon steel specially heat-treated to make them light and extra strong but not brittle. Gamakatsu ring hooks are made with a one-piece ring, no welds, no weak spots, a very smooth-moving ring. Gamakatsu offers a huge variety of hooks for all types of fishing. Live bait hooks, both light and heavy-duty to four extra strong. Circle hooks, tuna hooks, ringed hooks, tuna doubles, and many more. Don't waste your next fishing trip on a cheap hook. Get Gamakatsu hooks at your favorite tackle store now.
We all like to travel, whether it's for business or it's pleasure. But one thing we all like to do, it's save money. Well, we got a travel tip for you. Bill Boyce has put together a travel website for you that can save you a lot of money. You can become your own travel agent. The site is bookwithboyce.com. You're going to save yourself 5 to 35% on all nationally advertised travel rates. You want to go to Mexico? You want to go to Hawaii? Bookwithboyce.com can offer you outstanding prices. And here's the deal. There's no surprises for accommodations, rental cars, or activities. So try bookwithboyce.com now and thank Bill Boyce later on.
Quantum Fishing's gone and done it again for you with the brand new redesigned Smoke PT Reel Series. Everything from your spinning reels all the way to your bait casters, the PTA design has the new PTXA frame, lighter, stronger, bone-crushing drag. Quantum Fishing. We are performance-tuned. Check them out at Angler's Arsenal or anglersarsenal.com or give us a call at 619-466-8355. Hey, everybody. This is a message for our listeners from a new Baja Magic Lodge at Cedros Island. Cedros Outdoor Adventures wants to make your dream of fishing Cedros Island a reality. Want to go after giant calicos or yellowtail with the best Cedros Island fishing organization, but you just don't know who to contact? Then give Cedros Outdoor Adventures a call at 619-793-5419, or even better yet, log on to their informative website at cedrosoutdooradventures.com. There you can visit their trip calendar and schedule a trip that's convenient for you. Once again, the phone number is 619-793-5419. Or their website of CedrosOutdoorAdventures.com.
Rod and Reel Radio is brought to you by BajaBound.com Insurance Services. Are you driving to Mexico? You can buy and print out your Mexican auto insurance policy online in the convenience of your own home or office in minutes now with BajaBound.com's easy-to-use website. After printing your auto insurance, check out the BajaBound.com site. There, too, you will find great travel tips and information to help you get the most out of your next road trip south of the border. So this is an important fact to remember. Use BajaBound.com. It's the easiest way to find and get Mexican auto insurance. Stan, Wendy, and I, we want to welcome you back to Rod and Reel Radio. This hour's special guest is Mr. Jim Brown. He's the former San Diego City Lakes manager, and we're talking a little bit about how the largemouth bass got here to Southern California. And Jim, there's a couple of elements in the bass getting here that I think you skipped over. There was number one, how did they exactly get over here? Because we had some help there. And then when they finally got here, how were they transported to the lakes? Because that in itself was a story too.
Yeah, that's true, John. We're at a point where they lost the first batch And so they contracted for a second batch, and they were flown by the United States Navy from the Pensacola Air Base to the Miramar Naval Air Base. The fish then were moved from there and placed into Upper Otay Reservoir, which had been prepared for them. This batch was examined by the pathologist and judged to be fine. And at that point, everybody just had to wait and wonder for a while. And it was probably a year and a half later that the lake was just brimming with 10-inch Floridas, because the fish that they had, that they had brought in, they actually had some. They got an early spawn out of some fish, and it was really quite incredible, the number of Florida strain bass in there. And so they began catching those fish, placing them into garbage cans. And I had the good fortune, because my dad was involved with Orville and with Dave Jessup, he was involved in that process and urging that Florida bass, at least that this experiment go through. So it was a school day, and people were not too happy to see a kid there. I was a teenager at the time at Upper Otay, and we were filling up these buckets with the bass. All of a sudden, the bass started dying, and everyone was alarmed. And what had happened was the dam keeper at the time, who had been given shiny new garbage pails to be used for this, decided he'd rather use those in the portable toilets and take the ones that had been used in the portable toilets and use those for the fish transfer. So early on, there was a bit of a disaster. I don't know if I've ever told that story. They realized that these were old cans that had been contaminated, and they must have still had quite a bit of sediment in them. Anyway, they got some new garbage pails out. Then you transferred the fish from those into 55-gallon trash cans. And from there, the fish were placed into a live car, and state biologists were in the water, in waders, examining those fish and then moving them to a tank truck. And my recollection is the first load went to Miramar, which was a newly created reservoir. So I believe it was completed in about 61. The Floridas, the first live Floridas that survived here, got here in 60. And so they received some fish, and then they began being moved to other lakes as well. Just about every lake except for Barrett received them. And even farm ponds and golf course ponds, because there's something that is really frowned upon, but it's a fact of life, and it's called bucket biology. And the bucket biology is something that has happened almost forever involving the movement of fish. And that is, if you've got a stock pond, you've got a golf course pond, and you want some fish in it, well, heck, people would go sneak into Upper Otay, get some, put them in some buckets or ice chests, take them, dump them in. And the Florida strain bass just happens to have characteristics that make it very superior. And the number one characteristic in my mind is that because they spawn earlier, the fry that they produce feed on the fry of anything produced after them. And since the northerns would spawn a little bit later, they were very vulnerable to the predation by these little Floridas. And it wasn't long before lake records began to tumble. And I should point out that in those days, prior to the Floridas, lake records at almost every lake kind of were in the neighborhood of 7.5, 7.75 pounds. There's one notable exception, and that was a bass, a northern strain bass over 11 pounds, caught by the dam keeper at Lake Barrett during World War II when the lake was closed. And that's quite a remarkable fish to have occurred. However, let's go back to these Floridas. It didn't take long before their superior characteristics and the fact that when they interbred with the northern strain, their progeny had the Florida characteristics. So it was just a complete takeover of virtually every water around in San Diego, and the exception being Barrett, although some Floridas did leak into Barrett when Marina spilled. But, you know, that kind of takes us up to speed on how the Floridas got here. And, of course, the northern bass just became dominated.
Jim, do you have any idea of how many fish initially were brought over and put in lower Otay to get this whole thing going?
Well, I think you mean into upper Otay.
Upper Otay, I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah, and so I would have to go back and the book that I loaned out. John, next time I'm on the show, I'll try to have the number for you. But it was a fairly large group of fish that they put in. They grew very rapidly. They had no competition. And so, you know, I'm guessing somewhere in the hundreds. And they just, you know, the expansion of the Florida strain bass, it was just amazing.
Were you involved with the transfer of the bass into Diamond Valley, because those came out of San Diego too, and that was really kind of a small number of fish? Were you familiar with that story?
Yeah, and actually it was a large number of fish. We didn't, you know, Mike Giusti was the biologist working on that, and so, you know, at first Larry went out and got some fish for them. And at that time, Larry was a biologist working for the San Diego City Lakes program. He had left the Department of Fish and Game after they thought it was more important for him to study the Stevens kangaroo rat in Riverside. Yeah. And it wasn't very hard for me to lure Larry to come back to stay with San Diego. And of course, he polished off an absolutely dynamic career as a field biologist with the city of San Diego. There were actually large numbers. I mean, I know that we had talked about it and said they really need to put this many bass in, because, you know, one female bass, assuming every one of those eggs hatches and survives, and there's not too much competition, is going to produce enough fry to really get a lake started well. But they had hundreds and hundreds of them to do that. So, yeah, they really jump-started that lake with a large number of adult fish from here. The same thing happened up at Lake Silverwood. The Department of Water Resources was obligated, after they drained Silverwood, to restock it. And, you know, they just took a lot of adult bass out of San Diego and moved them up there. Most fish were taken from... Well, Hodges produced fish for them, San Vicente also, and probably El Cap. And I can get the real information for Larry, because even though Upper Otay was the designated bass hatchery and propagation area by the Department of Fish and Game, it was very difficult to get a shock boat in there. So they did take some fish directly from there, but I think Hodges was really a big donor to some of these other reservoirs.
Well, it seemed like the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s were the, if you want to call it, the golden age of bass fishing here in San Diego County. And that was a lot in part to you, or it was your watch. But why do you believe that these fish got even larger than the fish that you were seeing coming out of Florida and other parts of the country where the Florida strain were?
Well, you know, there are some people, Doug Hannon from Florida, who was a well-known biologist at the time, probably better known as a fisherman, you know, promoted the idea that these integrades or these F1s now, he would invariably call them hybrids, and technically they're not hybrids. They're intergrades, but they are a combination of the Florida strain and the northern strain. And you know, whether or not that is the key to them reaching and attaining a little bit larger size, I'm not really qualified to say. You know, the one thing I can do, John, or tell you, is that the things I know about, and I can talk about them. I'm not a fisheries biologist. I'm a very interested observer who's been very involved. But for a scientific explanation, I always yield to Larry.
I can understand that. Well, Stan, you had a question, I think, about the bass here. Did you want to hit Jim with that?
Sure. I actually started out to be a wildlife biologist.
So did I, Stan, but the only thing I couldn't handle was the math and science.
Well, I had to laugh at the beginning there because I had Oscar Brunetti, who was the head biologist for the state of California, bring a deer into our classroom, slap it on a table, and 32 kids in there. When he started cutting it, there were six of us left, and he asked that same question: "What do you want to do with your education?" And I told Oscar Brunetti, "You're the number one guy for the state, aren't you?" And he goes, "Yep." I go, "Well, I want your job." So
there you go.
There you go. And Stan,
it'll be another show, but we'll have to find out why you chose to read the fine print in insurance policies instead of the fine print in Field and Stream.
because I couldn't graduate. He offered me a job working with him, but I couldn't graduate in time. So I ended up fishing instead of being a biologist, which is okay. But one of my questions is, you know, people nowadays, we had a large amount of fish, big fish, and the largest in California, around the world, with our world records coming from here in, you know, San Diego Lakes and Castaic and Casitas. But then all of a sudden there's been, you know, everybody goes, well, what happened? But, you know, fish don't live forever either. Right. What's the lifespan of these big fish? And then why haven't we seen a progression on bigger fish since that date or those times back, 10 years ago now?
You know, I can only point to the one factor in a lot of these lakes, and that is that at one time they were very heavily stocked with rainbow trout. And yep. I know from being on the shock boat with Larry at Lake Murray in particular, I was stunned that when I would, you know, net a fish and put it into the holding tank, you would look down into its gullet and there would be a minimum of one tail of a rainbow trout in its gullet. And I'm not talking about big bass. I'm talking about 2-pound, 3-pound bass. And as you continued to, you know, keep, you know, pulling in these shocked fish, I saw them with as many as three tails of rainbows sticking out of their gullet. And wow. That's why the fish that were put into San Vicente, as an example, the Department of Fish and Game fish were returned, according to Larry's creel census data, at about 7%. So 7 out of every 100 bass ended up in the creel taken home by an angler. Now, we also know there was a huge take of Florida bass by the guys who were catching, of trout, by the guys catching them and using them as bait. That's a little bit different story, though. So there's great predation on rainbow trout when they're a little too small. So I always wrote the contracts for the fish that the city purchased for those fish to average about 1.5 pounds. And that tended to be a trout that maybe only the biggest of the bass in the lake was going to eat. So, you know, the trout were certainly a big factor for those fish. But I still think that the most significant bass caught in Southern California was the 20-pound 4-ouncer caught at Lake Hodges, because sure. You're talking about a lake that was not stocked with trout but just did have an abundance of other fish in it. So people have often made comments in passing that those fish are so big because they're eating trout. Well, that's true in some lakes, but that's not true of one of the most beautiful bass that was ever caught in San Diego County.
Well, not only that, Gene Dupree went back the next week and got one that was about 17 plus, almost in that same spot. So he had a couple of really nice fish come out of that spot.
Yeah, and also, John, just to interrupt you, so I had caught and released a 16, and it was caught that next weekend by a teenager as well.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, Jim, tell us a little bit about the dynamics of the San Diego Lakes as a whole, because we have a lot of visitors come here from other parts of the country. A lot of people come to San Diego to settle, and they're bass fishermen. They want to go fishing in the San Diego City Lakes, and they go, well, wait a minute. I don't have those restrictions at home. What do you mean I've got to sit in line? Could you, just in a brief nutshell, tell us why the dynamic of the San Diego City Lakes is different than, let's say, a lake where someone comes from that's run by the TBA or something like that?
Sure, sure. I mean, first of all, look north to L.A. County. The Los Angeles Department of Water and Power has plenty of reservoirs up there, but you're not allowed to fish on any of them. The difference in San Diego is that in 1913, when the city of San Diego purchased the core of its reservoir system from John Spreckels and Colonel Ed Fletcher, there was a history of fishing, hunting, camping, picnicking on those lakes. And in fact, it was a way for the caretaker, which later became known as a dam keeper, but it was a way for the caretaker to make a little extra money. And in fact, some of them were very famous for turning their homes into essentially a bed and breakfast. But my point is, there was an established system of people being allowed access to these lakes. When the city of San Diego purchased these water supply reservoirs, the California Department of Health stepped in and said, we really couldn't regulate the private enterprise. We couldn't stop Fletcher and we couldn't stop Spreckels, but we can stop you. So the state of California is ordering the city of San Diego to cease and desist from allowing the public on these primary water supply reservoirs, which must be closed and for the protection of the water supply and the citizens those lakes serve. The city council did not like this at all, because in those days, fishing on the lakes and hunting on the lakes was a huge issue. You didn't have people at the La Jolla Beach and Tennis Club. You didn't have people at the old Stardust Golf Club. The real movers and shakers in San Diego, you know where they were in those days? They were in a duck blind or they were in a boat. And that's where they went for recreation. That's where lawyers and engineers and contractors kind of went out and talked and worked out their deals. And it's just really crazy that the city filed suit against the state of California. And in 1913, the state backed off and said, okay, these are water supply reservoirs, so you have to do them under conditions that are acceptable to us. So the city of San Diego promulgated rules that were acceptable to the state Department of Health Services, and our reservoirs still operate on that basis. They're water supply first, they're recreation secondary. Our water here is a very precious commodity. We only have the rainfall and runoff to serve 50,000 residents here. We have a whole lot more people, so we import water. Most of the folks I would deal with in the old days in my offices would be here from another state. And as you say, John, they were used to the fact that if you want to go fishing, hitch up the boat, go down, get on the launch ramp, and go fishing. But those were typically not primary water supply reservoirs. Often in those states, there was an abundance of natural lakes. And so people had all of those opportunities. And I have to sympathize with people who could not understand when they got here, you have to have a permit? Really? You have to wait and go in when they tell you you can go in. You have to get off the lake when they tell you. And so, yeah, we kind of had a, you know, a supermarket approach to trying to solve that problem.
Well, that was also another problem. The fact you mentioned it, people had to pay to fish. They had to pay to launch. Why was that necessary in light of just going on a lake, launching, and going fishing, Jim?
Well, the city of San Diego sold water bonds years ago, and they created an issue, and that is that if you're a water bond holder, the purpose of that agency that you're backing is to provide water supply. And anything that deviates from that, you should not have to pay for. So if the bondholders were not going to pay for recreation, it became a pay-as-you-go kind of a system in which, in order to provide recreation, it was simply absolutely necessary to charge a fee for the people using those lakes so that you could recoup the cost that is entailed in providing them the opportunity to go fish or to go hunt, or in more modern times, water ski or jet ski.
You know, we have a limited amount of time left, Jim. You wanted to bring up an issue of currently some of the issues that are happening at Lake Otay. Do you want to just basically tell us what the problem is and what seems to be happening there?
Well, it's coincidentally, this is the 60th anniversary of Upper Otay having been converted into a Florida bass hatchery. And so the lake, of course, prospered. It's produced fish that have moved all around the world. I believe probably somewhere between 18 and 20 of the largest bass of all time originated from the Florida bass that began in Upper Otay. But about 3 or 4 years ago, there was a major fish kill, and the bass fishing community, and I'm talking about the club and tournament anglers, were not really tuned into that, because mainly there's another bass fishing community, and that involved the folks who float tube or fish from shore at Upper Otay, and they were enjoying the lake greatly. All of a sudden, they couldn't catch a fish. So there was apparently a major die-off. The Upper Otay is really not even a part of our water system anymore. The water can't really be moved unless it's pumped out, and it's a very small volume of water. So the water department does not really even consider it a significant or even an insignificant part of the water system. It's just there, and it's historic. So people have approached me beginning yesterday, asking how they could approach the agencies involved, and those would be the City of San Diego and the Department of Fish and Wildlife, to try to bring Upper Otay back. So they are planning a meeting, and I have agreed to just provide them with some consulting advice free of charge as to how they can go about approaching the agencies in a rational way and trying to come up with an analysis of what is wrong with the water, or is anything wrong with the water in Upper Otay, and can we get back to it becoming a Florida bass location, with the state recognizing that it's the one that identified it as a state propagation area of Florida bass, and really they haven't done anything to ensure that it continues to be that.
You know, there was a time when it was looked that the San Diego City Lakes would be under the jurisdiction of the Parks Department, just like the golf courses that are here in San Diego went under the jurisdiction of the Parks Department. Why didn't that happen, Jim?
Well, I was hired in 74, and in 78 was the Jarvis Tax Initiative. And once the Jarvis Tax Initiative passed, the tax monies available to local agencies and cities began to decline. And the city of San Diego was forced to make cuts in the Park and Rec Department. So anytime there is a crisis financially, the main cuts go to libraries and recreation. That's going to happen again, given the current circumstances in the country. But in 1981, they finally looked at it. They said, we just can't run the program. We don't want to cut a program that's doing so well, and we don't have the money to run it. But the water department, we think they can figure out a way to do it. So we'll transfer this program back to the water department. So the water department did have the program from 1913 until about 1966. And around that era, it went over to Park and Rec. I was there 74 to 81. And then the program, you know, came back to the water department. And it was, here's the deal. The Park and Rec department had the philosophy of public recreation, but not the money. The water department had the money, but arguably not the concept of public recreation.
Yeah, and so we're in the situation that we are today, where it seems like the recreational part of the water utilities department is the red-haired, freckled-faced kid of the group, and as a result, we run into some of the problems now that I know you look at it, and maybe sometimes you have to shake your head and going, man, this is not the program that I left when I was running it.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, it's very, very difficult, John, looking back. Within 6 months of my retirement, I had employees telling me that they were being instructed to no longer assist the public, not to be visible, and not to be present on the dock. It's just the way it is. I had fought those kinds of attitudes and succeeded, and it just became impossible for anyone that followed me to do the same thing, to be quite honest.
Well, Jim, there's a whole lot more we could do. Is there a book maybe somewhere in the offing on your experiences with the San Diego City Lakes? Because we haven't even scratched the surface when it comes to the stories and the individuals that were involved in the lakes here in San Diego and actually throughout all of Southern California.
John, I have been asked for a long time. And when I was a kid, I picked out a title, and it was going to be fishing-oriented, and it was going to be The Angler's Guide to the Inland Waters of San Diego County. How's that for a specific title? and it's a little bit long. And then I decided to write one called Lake Boy that was more about my personal experiences. And I've probably got 100-150 pages in my computer. It tells some of the stories, but some of it is more personal and personalized maybe. Sure. Than telling the story about the water department or the park and rec department. It's just, you know, it sits there, and I sometimes go in and read back some of the things I've written. I have produced some things for SD Fish. And so there's a few historical pieces that I put into sdfish.com, and they're also called Lake Boy on that site.
I can't wait to read Lake Boy.
I can't wait to write it.
Yeah. Hey, Jim, that's our time for tonight. But if you will, can we call upon you again and we can share some other stories with you?
John, anytime you want to call, that'd be fine. During this current period of time, I'm spending a lot of time here in the house with my dog watching Netflix.
Aren't we all? Hey, Jim, thanks for being with us and sharing your time with us. Appreciate it.
And good luck to all of you.
All right. Hey, Stan and Wendy, thanks a lot for your input tonight. That's it for tonight. Shangri-La.
Well, you know,
we'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, we'll go back to the Ilona virus and hang out with ourselves, and we'll be back next week with more.
Yeah. Hey, we do plan a live show next week. So, ladies and gentlemen, until then, that's it. We want to thank Otto and the AM 540 Studios, Ben, our local producer, and always in memory of Big Tuna Bill, Eddie McCune,